So good evening. I would, before I start, just like to recognize the folks here on the presentation. Dr. Staton, the intervention that I'm going to talk about is Pasos Adelante, is Dr. Staton's work, and her she's the developer of the intervention. Kirsten is also part of the research organization Canyon Ranch Center for Prevention and Health Promotion, and is her specialty has been on integrating information on stress and depression into the Pasos Adelante intervention. Chris and Denise are statisticians, and Rosie's been integral to delivering the intervention in Douglas, Dunn Douglas, Arizona. Oops. I have no financial or commercial interest to disclose as part of this intervention or talk. Just a really brief overview, because there's really, you know, obviously sort of a limited time, but as most of you know, chronic disease make up the sort of current leading causes of death amongst all populations, but among Hispanics, 4 out of the 5 leading causes of death, so cancer, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and diabetes. The only other one of the top 5 leading causes of death are that is not a chronic disease are accidental injuries. There are sort of particular concerns about chronic disease and the chronic disease risk factors along populations at the U.S.-Mexico border. These populations are disproportionately affected by diabetes and risk factors for diabetes, such as low physical activity, and obesity, and often have lower access to healthcare services. And when I'm sort of speaking of the border population, this would be the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, and specifically borders, the sort of border is often defined by sort of 62 miles north of the border and south of the border. There are longstanding and very well-documented cross-sectional and longitudinal relationships between chronic disease and chronic disease risk factors and health-related quality of life, and I'll define that in a few minutes, and depression, whether you look at it as and measure it as mental health disorders, DSM-3, DSM-4, actually very soon now DSM-5, defined mental disorder or as symptoms, depressive symptoms, psychological distress. And Pasos Adelante, which is what I'm going to talk about today, is translated into what's called Steps Forward in English. And this is a chronic disease preventive intervention and offered in a Southwest border community, and that's the community I'm going to talk about today. And the aim was to look at the intervention, look at the impacts on health-related quality of life and depressive symptoms. So there we are, but we're at the green arrow is where Douglas, Arizona is located. As you can see, very close, right on the border of US, the United States and Mexico. And we're located up in Tucson, the University of Arizona. Population of Douglas is a relatively small community. It didn't include sort of its history, but it's sort of the history of a mining town. Local businesses include sort of retail, Walmart, very little tourism. It's primarily Hispanic. The larger county, Cochise County, is a bit more diverse. And most of the population is, or over half of the population, is about 200% below, 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. So it's not a wealthy, population. And here are some pictures of participants in Pasos Adelante, which is basically the intervention is comprised of educational sessions and physical activity. And I'll expand on that in a minute. This intervention was part of a larger research agenda that is funded by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Arizona Research Prevention Research Center, under the larger umbrella of a Canyon Ranch Center for Health Promotion and Prevention. And Pasos Adelante was sort of the community prevention program component of a larger research agenda that included a family education on diabetes and education for patients who were receiving treatment for diabetes. The curriculum was developed from a National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute curriculum called Su Corazón, Su Vida, Your Heart, Your Life, which was a curriculum, educational curriculum, focused on chronic disease and cardiovascular disease factors, oriented towards Hispanic, Latino populations. One of the changes and modifications to Pasos Adelante, Dr. Staten made was to add walking groups, opportunities for structured physical activity. And also to sort of enhance, to enhance social support. The intervention was piloted in Santa Cruz, Yuma, and since 2003 it's been implemented in Douglas, Arizona. So the educational components are 12 sessions handled weekly, addressed weekly in a two-hour group, in a group intervention, not individual sessions, and individually, delivered to groups, not individuals, sorry. And these are the topics, being at risk for heart disease, how to be more physically active, are you at risk for diabetes, and the asterisks are next to three sessions that were developed specifically for PASOS. So these were additions to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's curriculum, which were specifically focused on diabetes, glucose, and sugar, and I'll show you in a minute community advocacy. So high blood pressure, of course, high blood pressure, hypertension, a chronic disease, a risk factor. Educating folks about fat, saturated fat, healthy weight, as obesity, and high cholesterol, of course, also risk factors, maintenance of healthy weight. Also, this community advocacy piece was very important to the community advisory board and the community at large that were involved in the development of the intervention and the delivery of the intervention down in Douglas, which was to try to start a dialogue about what other kinds of community factors might be related to either development or sort of maintenance of poor health in the community. So to really sort of highlight the impact of sort of lack of walking trails or not lack of grocery store offerings that may not be particularly healthy, you know, to try to start looking at those multiple layers of influence on our health behaviors that go beyond just individual food and physical activity choices. So glucose and sugar, eating, how to engage family members in healthy eating. The sessions really wanted to recognize the sort of social context and cultural context of eating and food provision. So, you know, that it's certainly the intervention was particularly attended by women. It's open, of course, to women and men, but we did have a preponderance of female participants in the intervention. And recognizing that they're buying for their family and their food, what they buy for their family, how they cook for their family is certainly influenced by what their husbands and children say and the extended family members. So recognizing these factors were very important and relationships were important in the intervention and educational sessions and discussions. And recognizing that finances impact how people choose their food and what they can make. And smoking, of course, is a risk factor. And then a review of these sort of key components and a graduation and a potluck as well. Briefly, sort of social cognitive, social learning theory, inform the intervention. Certainly post the sort of highlighting the importance of personal goal setting, setting small incremental goals for change in physical activity and nutrition, and having the participants monitor those for themselves, bring them up as part of the discussion. The curriculum is structured and has is structured by order and content, but it also allows for flexibility. This is not a deviate one or two word from the curriculum, and you've changed it in ways that we don't feel are helpful. It has to be flexible, given that lay health workers are delivering it and want to sort of foster a sense of conversation and relaxation in the group sessions. And also the intervention attempted to be sensitive to cultural and community norms in terms of the kinds of recipes and types of foods and ways of delivering the materials. So here are some pictures of Lourdes Fernandez and Marta Barrera, and Blanca Robles, who are promotores down in Douglas, providing the sessions, often happening in churches and other kinds of community locations. Physical activity was a component. In all the sessions, there was some kind of movement activity, often a walk at the end of the session, and structured walking groups. So each week, each of the 12 weeks, there was a scheduled session for walking. These built up to 3 times a week. With the promotoras, the community health workers, walking with the participants. And then slowly the promotoras would decrease their attendance with the participants, trying to facilitate them moving towards walking, setting their own, identifying their own community workers and community participants to walk with the participants in hopes that sustainability would happen. I'm gonna move more quickly through recruitment eligibility, so anyone in the community was eligible. Assessments were done at baseline, post-intervention, and 3-month follow-up, included a variety of demographic, dietary, physical activity and indicators, behaviors, anthropometric measurements, and fasting blood tests. I won't go into the anthropometric and fasting blood clinical indicators and outcomes. There will be some work forthcoming from that, but there were positive and impacts on reductions in weight and reductions in cholesterol, blood pressure, triglycerides in the anticipated directions. Quality of life, as many of you all may know, is really sort of getting at perceived mental and physical health, getting beyond the necessary presence of a clinical condition, looking more at sort of people's perceived health and well-being. Measured by the healthy days measures that the CDC uses as part of the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, self-rated health, days physical health are not good, days mental health is not good, days that activities are limited due to poor mental or physical health. And depressive symptoms were measured by this CESD, looking at frequency, symptom frequency in the last 7 days. And these results are on the 207 participants who completed all pre-post and follow-up assessments. As you can see, the majority of the participants were female, Hispanic, primarily Spanish speakers, many born in Mexico, more than half married, most unemployed, and many did not graduate from high school. The majority were overweight or obese, had a high BMI to begin with, and a number of them, at least over, you know, over half, 66%, had one or more conditions. This is not necessarily current chronic conditions, but had ever reported ever having been diagnosed with a chronic condition. Very few smokers, low level of smoking, and a little over half had current health insurance. So here are our baseline post and follow-up mean levels of physical and healthy days, mentally unhealthy days, and the healthy days index, which is just the sum of physical and mentally unhealthy days, and those are subtracted from 30. So how many days were you free from poor physical or mental health? And activities limited, days activity limited, and the CESD score looked at continuously. So here are our change reported from, we had a significant reduction in mentally unhealthy days from baseline to post-test, which is 12 weeks, a significant increase in healthy days, no impacts on days of limited activity, and CESD score was significant, but I'll talk about the questionable clinical significance of that in just a second. And then from follow-up, so that was 3-month follow-up post-intervention to baseline. We still had a sustained impact on mentally unhealthy days reductions and in healthy days increase. Again, nothing with the limited activity days. Still a significant CESD score. And these are our paired results. These are McNamara's paired results, paired tests. So what you're really looking at here is sort of the, for people who reported fair health at baseline, but reporting excellent or very good health compared to, at post-intervention, compared to the 14 reporting that they were doing really well before the intervention started and then doing poorly after. So that's what we would want to see. Frequent mental distress is just a dichotomization of mentally unhealthy days to try to map to the 2 week sort of symptom time frame that we often look at when we're thinking about depression. Major depressive disorder, but it isn't a disorder diagnosis. We see positive in the direction that we'd want to see, sort of decreases in the proportion reporting frequent mental distress from baseline to post. And not when we looked at just the CESD score dichotomously, which is the way it is typically used in the literature, above a cut point of 16 indicating potential clinical distress, not impacts. The self-rated health, there was a positive impact on self-rated health that was not sustained at follow-up. Mental distress, all right, that impact was sustained. So what do we make of this? So we do see some significant changes from pre to post, baseline to post, maintained at follow-up, particularly with unhealthy days, frequent mental distress, and some self-rated improvements in self-rated health, but just during the time that the intervention occurred, not at follow-up. While there were significant changes in the CESD score, again, all the means were below the cut point of 16, so I'm not sure that we really feel confident about saying much about that. And I would say that the intervention, well, of course, we're looking at health-related quality of life and depressive symptoms, the intervention itself was a chronic disease focused intervention, not focused on identifying people with mental health conditions or depressive symptoms and really specifically addressing that. So I think that's, of course, important to keep in mind. So now we need to look at factors that might be associated with frequent mental distress, change in frequent mental distress, particularly when we're looking at physical activity and some of the other demographic factors. We have some open-ended qualitative data for people who reported that they perceived their health as changing during the intervention period and after. It was asked of what do you attribute that change? And so we have an opportunity to take a look at that. We'll be doing that. Of course, longer term change needs to be monitored. And really, of course, this is a single subject design. So without a control group, a number of alternative hypotheses for change really can't be adequately explored. And Dr. Staton is looking at sort of taking that next step in the future research. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Dr. Cutshaw? Or for any of our other speakers?
I'm sorry?
Acculturation.
We didn't construct an acculturation scale. I suppose you could. We have Spanish speaking and Spanish reading preference, as well as sort of location of birth, which would be U.S. or Mexico or somewhere up not in the U.S. But we didn't construct any sort of index of acculturation. That's a good point. Most of the residents had lived in Douglas for quite a while, but we didn't know. That's a great, yes, they are. That's a very good question. One of the interesting things is this intervention was done in Tucson with a much younger population, and we're starting to look at that information now, that data now, with families in Head Start programs, younger families, younger women, predominantly women again. And the walking groups were somewhat successful, not nearly as successful with the younger population as with the older. Zumba and other kinds of structured activities and volleyball, were much more engaging to our younger participants. But from among the older participants, some of the walking groups still are going in Douglas. Yes. That's an excellent question, and I would say I came to this particular data. I haven't actually had much contact with the people. I haven't had contact with people in Douglas as I've had with the people here here in Tucson, with the replication of it. So I don't know. I think there'd be other, I think Kirsten or Lisa or my colleagues would be better able to speak at whether those conversations occurred during the educational sessions, for example, kind of drawing those connections. There are a number of people who've done some very sort of good work at kind of explaining that relationship between sort of mental health and sort of, I think there's either sort of constructs that kind of explain or get at depression that are sort of more culturally defined, and so there are a number of people that have thought about that a little bit more, but I don't know, unless those conversations were sort of specifically organized or targeted by the curriculum, I'm just not sure, you know, how much it how much they were making those or making those connections versus the, you know, the facilitators bringing them up, or how comfortable they were, whether they felt more comfortable talking about somatic symptoms, for example, rather than sort of depression per se. Well, I think that, yes, and actually Kirsten Reinschmidt, Dr. Reinschmidt, has developed some other curriculum components called Sonrisa, particularly oriented towards mental health and stress, and particularly talking about stress as a construct for the population, and I believe is looking at integrating that. And I think the other thing that's really important is that even though this is a chronic disease prevention program sort of delivered in the community, not identifying people at risk per se to participate, I mean, it was open recruitment, the fact that there are people who are at the end of the intervention, post-intervention, reporting mental distress means that we need to pay better attention to that in sort of in a more systematic way, perhaps screen on exit and make sure people are linked to health services or directed towards resources in the community, because it's really not enough to say, well, you know, to sort of raise those issues or identify them and then not really leave anybody with any kind of contacts or referrals or other kinds of information. So, thank you.
Please join me in thanking our speakers once again. Thank you for coming this afternoon.